So I sure hope that sermon title that is on the order of service near you doesn't turn out to be false advertising today. Because the four words that I handed Kelly 12 days ago or more, well, they were attached to a sermon that started 12 days ago or more and has taken some turns on a curvy road to get where we are today. In fact, Chuck stepped up here a minute ago and said, you know, no one's ever told me whether the water was turned to red wine or white wine. That's a great question. I don't have any idea. But don't you like the question? So I think the sermon title might still work, but it's going to feel a little bit like new shoes, I think, to us. Because what I'm wondering today is if you haven't forgotten something essential. You know, like when you lose your keys somewhere, the little heart attack. Oh, my keys, my phone. Or for you, it might be a purse or a wallet or maybe a kid in the grocery cart at the grocery store. Yeah. You ever done any of those things? I think it sounds like you have with your laughing. There's this quick grip of panic that swipes our breath and squeezes our heart. And then there's this loud silence of an unreturned thought or memory racing around in our head. And if there is any word in our head echoing, maybe a tsunami of this one word, where, aghast, right? And your heart is clenched a little bit. I think it, to me, is like a garden hose lying in the grass with one of those darn kinks in it. Nothing gets through for a minute or two. So focused on finding what's missing, what's lost, we tune out everything for a time, lost to us. So focused on finding what's missing, what's lost, we just tune it right out. So I'm wondering this morning if we've misplaced something essential, but don't yet know that we've left it somewhere. One term at university, I woke up more than one morning that fall, panicked that I had forgotten a test or a paper that was due, and I'd wake up panicked with a gasp. Fear of failure waking you up, slapping me awake, jerked awake, really, fear-struck. So distracted was I that fall term that I locked my keys in my car 10 or 12 times, which means some weeks I did it more than once. So distracted. I drove back then this 81 Chevy El Camino that was cinnamon-colored. I really liked this car. It was a car in the front. You know how El Caminos work, right? Car up front, truck out back. It looks like somebody's karate chopped a station wagon and just slid the whole top off of the back. My friends called it a trar. I called her Bertha because she became my friend. She was a great car. She went further than any car I've ever had with more wrong with her. She just kept on going, rattling, clunking, dropping stuff off. I parked her one day near the campus union and grabbed my backpack and went to class, and came back later to the car and started looking for my keys, which were not in my pocket, but on the other side of the window, lean in, frown, and squint, and oh, dang it, not again. Mitchell, what the world? It happened so often that I became an expert at finding and bending a wire coat hanger into a fancy door unlocker. Click, I could pull that thing up. One day, after several reruns of this very same episode, with boring frequency, they're in there again. This time, though, I had this thought. Instead of tossing this coat hanger, I'm going to slide this fancy wire coat hanger door unlocker right behind Bertha's back seat. It'll be there next time. I was so relieved and even excited about it. And I went on, I don't know, maybe a week before the next time I came up to the car and found my pockets empty and thought, dang, oh, no dang, that thing is right in there. Where that moment, I realized it. I'd gone a week without, well, I'd gone a week oblivious, really, peacefully oblivious. Are you and I walking around quietly oblivious that we may have lost something essential and haven't yet discovered that we've left it somewhere? Like a lost wedding ring that just slipped off your hand. Do you know last Sunday, Mitch Randall, our guest preacher, in the middle of worship, recognized that his wedding ring was no longer on his hand. In the middle of worship, he'd lost it somewhere the weekend here in Austin. And I don't know how he did it. He went on to preach a fine sermon. Wouldn't your mind have gone out of your head looking everywhere for that? Left you alone. My mind would have left me there in the pulpit and gone searching every corner of Austin where I had been, every step. But he didn't. He delivered a fine sermon. And at the end of worship, met us at the door, shook our hand, sent us on the way. But then, well, he went frantically looking. Looked in here. He looked up the hallways. He looked up in your office. He looked in his bag. Nope. Called the Uber driver. Nope. Roy takes him to the hotel where he finally finds the thing wrapped in a cloth at the sink in his room. He simply hadn't noticed the ring had just slipped off his hand. So he's washing his hands that morning. Is it possible in the traffic of our living that we have simply forgotten we belong together? We belong together. And I'm wondering if it's possible that Jesus' first act at that wedding there in Cana, and his last act here among us, and every act really in between, including right now, is just that, bringing us together like Mitch and his wedding ring last Sunday. Wouldn't you love to have seen Mitch's face last Sunday when he found that ring? Gosh, I would have loved it. You know that feeling too, right? You've lost something, gone around, panicked, heart, I almost know where. And then you find it. It's a thrill, right? There's something about it. I have trouble finding the words. It's more than relief, although relief is in there. It's more than joy, although that's in there too. Is delight a big enough word? What word do you put on a moment like that? Ecstatic. You find something. Found it. Waiting at the airport to pick up friends or family, or maybe waiting on your own bags. Have you ever been distracted or drawn to or captivated by the small reunions that are going on around you? Yeah? These wide hugs and these big eyes and usually no words even, but sometimes there's tears and always there's more than enough love to be felt from a distance in there. May not even know those people, but all of a sudden, whew, heart's warmed, life's warmed. This, my friends, Highland Park, this is exactly what God has been doing since the beginning of creation, gathering us up, running to us when a great reunion brings us all together, and is what God is doing right now, bringing us all together, everyone. Helping us remove the great distances that we somehow put so often in between us. Could it be that we just have simply forgotten that we all belong together? Can it be that simple? I don't think it's an accident that John tells us Jesus begins his ministry at a wedding. What an impossibly beautiful idea, the joining together of two lives, two families or more, traditions, histories, cultures woven together right there at the altar, tied together with a promise and a blessing and a kiss, held together with love and sheer will. Two lives fashioning a new way together in their differences, learning to put their differences on the table, and on their table, learning to speak and to hear the hard and the whole truth with each other. Could today's story also be a metaphor for creation, for our living? Is this just a huge wedding feast that we're at right now, y'all? All around us? The whole family and our family's family and our family's family's family and our friends and the friends' friends and the friends' friends' friends and our neighbors and their neighbors and the people we invite to help. All in on this great celebration. The wild promise, not just of this new way of living, less alone way of living. This promise exchanged and witnessed. The promise of maybe a new family, grandchildren. The promise and miracle of someone giving away some of their freedom and someone taking up someone else's burdens together. I don't think it's a small miracle. And this Highland Park is our calling. And I know you know this. And I know you believe this. I've seen it in you. And you've seen it in each other, haven't you? But it's so darn easy, really, to let it slip from our living without a sound of a ring, bing, hitting the floor silently. It can just slip from our living. You know you belong to each other. You belong to that crazy loon in their car in the lane next to you that you're about to blow your horn at on their way home too. And that loon belongs to you, y'all. You belong to the waitress at the table. Have you noticed her tattered shoes? How much will you tip her? Do you know her name? Are you going to give her your name? One day before he left the office, Fred Craddock's wife, Nettie, called him and said, "Fred, would you mind stopping at the store and picking up some peanut butter? We're out of peanut butter here at the house." "Oh, sure, Nettie, I'd be glad to," and he does. At the store, Fred finds himself disoriented. "How long has it been since I've been in this store?" he says. "The place has become a foreign land to me." Up and down several aisles with no luck, he finally turns to this lady. "Pardon me, ma'am. Can you help me find the peanut butter?" "Well, I never," she huffed. And she clutched her handbag, and she, on her heels, went the other way, looking back at him. "What just happened here?" Fred likes, "Yikes, it has been a while since I've been to the grocery store, I guess." Well, he goes back to the search, and he finally finds the peanut butter aisle. And he finds himself standing in front of an ocean of options. Puts his hand on his forehead. "How can there be such a variety of labels? I should have asked Nettie." He pulls one off of the shelf to take a closer look, hoping it'll look familiar to him, when he spots over his glasses that lady coming down the aisle toward him. Uh-oh. She comes right up to him. "Oh, you really did want to know how to find the peanut butter. Well, you do understand, one can never be too careful." Fred, without missing a beat, says, Yes, ma'am," still smiling. "I believe you can be too careful." Are you being too careful out there, Highland Park? I don't think Mary was being too careful that day at the wedding. Somehow Mary, you know, Jesus' mama, well, she noticed that the wedding was in trouble, about to have a train wreck. She somehow noticed that the wine was giving out. She didn't return to her seat. She didn't fold her hands nicely in her lap. She didn't smile politely, look the other way. When her boy dismissed her, "Mom, not now, not yet, not time," she, you know what she does, right? She turns to the servants. "Do whatever he asks," she tells them. And they do, which puts the servants in a position to see something no one else there saw, a miracle that we, still some 2,000 years later, are talking about. There is no evidence that Mary handed Jesus there any instructions to unfold on how to fix the impending mess at that wedding. It seems she just pointed her son to a need and asked the servants to help. What in the world do you think motivated Mary to step in there? What would motivate you to step in when you step in? Because I've seen you step in. What keeps you in your seat when you stay in your seat? Several weeks into the bus boycott, exhausted from attempting to be a pastor and a husband and a father and the director of the local civil rights movement, and after a relentless stream of harassing and obscene phone calls, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. hears the phone ring that he answers near midnight, which he considers a genuine death threat at midnight in his home. Got out of bed, went to the kitchen, made some coffee, sat at the table, and began thinking how he could get his family out of this mess, go another way, without looking like a coward. In the state of exhaustion, he writes, "When my courage had all but gone, I decided to take my problem to God. With my head in my hands, I bowed over the kitchen table and prayed aloud. The words I spoke to God that night are still vivid in my memory. I'm here taking a stand for what I believe is right, but now I'm afraid. The people are looking to me for leadership, and if I stand before them without strength and courage, they will falter too. I am at the end of my powers. I have nothing left. I've come to the point where I can't face this alone," he writes. "At that moment, I experienced the presence of the divine as I've never experienced him before. It seemed as though I could hear a quiet assurance of an inner voice saying, 'Stand up for righteousness. Stand up for truth. And God will be at your side.'" Almost at once, he writes, "My fears began to go, my uncertainty disappeared, and I was ready to face anything." And so King steps into the current of a river that had been flowing towards justice for more than 100 years with Sojourner Truth and Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman and W.E.B. Du Bois and Diane Nash and Jimmie Lee Jackson and Rosa Parks and Edgar Meyers and Barbara Jordan. Highland Park, we'd be wise tomorrow and maybe right now to remember all these lives with King's life, but also to acknowledge that the river they stepped into together with so many other people has yet to reach open water.
We are bound together in our desire to see the world become a place in which our children can grow free and strong.
It's so darn easy to let slip from our lives what is so very essential. You are not alone. You never have been. You never will be. We are all connected, y'all. Maybe it's why we put these bands on our hands at a wedding, or we come into a room like this to remember that in the shadow of every valley, and in the brilliant morning light, and in the desert of our living, and in the windy beach, and the quiet right now, you are never alone.
We are bound together by the task that stands before us and the road that lies ahead. We are bound and we are bound.
Will you pray with me? Please, dear God, when you call, help us hear.